How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on Wrestling Observer Live. We're here for the next 2 hours talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. One of the most historic weeks in the history of this program, as we're going to be talking about one of the biggest stories in all of MMA, the tap-out loss last night by Fedor Emelianenko, his first loss in competition in 10 years. The consensus by most people, best heavyweight in the history of the sport, faced Fabricio Werdum last night at the Strikeforce show in San Jose. Stuck his head right into a triangle armbar combination, couldn't get out, and was forced to tap. So Fabricio Werdum, after all these years, ended the incredible win streak of Fedor. He'd only lost a single fight in his entire career, and it was a blood stoppage in a fight that he was winning, and a blood stoppage as a result of an illegal elbow. So, realistically, he'd never lost a fight before, and he made the big mistake last night, and he paid for it. We're going to talk about that the rest of the Strikeforce show, including, at least to me, one of the worst examples of officiating of all time, which is really saying something if you've been following the show and listened to some of the things we've ranted about in the past. We're going to talk about the retirement of one of the all-time greats. Frank Shamrock is hanging it up. We'll tell you about that. Also, preview next week's big UFC event. It is Brock Lesnar versus Shane Carwin for the UFC heavyweight title in Las Vegas. We'll talk about that fight, the lackluster hype leading up to it, whether it will still break records or come close to records. We'll talk about all that. Plus, wrestling news. There's a lot of it. We'll recap the Fatal 4-Way pay-per-view from last weekend. Talk about Raw from this past Monday night, the NXT angle. Raw, of course, from this next Monday night, tomorrow, in fact. We'll talk about that. The guest host for that show, who has pretty much been a big mystery up until, well, I guess today when we're talking about it here on the show. Talk about last week's WEC, the Martha Hart lawsuit, TNA Impact from this past Thursday night. More on NXT. Mike actually watched the WWE Superstars show. We'll tell you about that, plus the Ricky Steamboat DVD. I saw Chris Jericho on Downfall. I'll tell you about that. This show actually exists, and it appears to be still ongoing, believe it or not. And we'll talk about Batista and his possible foray into mixed martial arts. So much stuff to talk about today. We'll take your phone calls and emails as well. You can always send emails throughout the week to WOL at WrestlingObserver.com. We'll be back in just a moment to kick this show off. 2 hours. You're listening to the Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Radio Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com, here for the next 2 hours, talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. And, of course, kicking it off with the story of Fedor Emelianenko tapping out after being caught in a triangle at the hands and feet of Fabricio Werdum. Main event of the show last night from the HP Pavilion. Squared off, Fedor rushed in, immediately knocked him down with a punch, went down to the ground to finish, nearly got locked in an armbar. He managed to fight his way free, and then, for God only knows what reason, he stayed in the man's guard. He continued trying to punch him in the face, and as he stayed in the guard, Werdum put him in a triangle, tried to submit him with a triangle armbar combination. Fedor fought for quite a while and finally tapped a single time on the thigh of Fabricio Werdum, and the referee stopped the fight. First loss in 10 years for Fedor Emelianenko. Talked about it at the press conference afterwards that he found himself in a bad position. He had a moment when he had a chance to escape, and he just didn't. And he got caught and was unable to get out, and he said that a lot of people have put me on a pedestal in the past. A lot of people have called me an idol, but I'm just a human being. Everybody loses. It was God's will that I lost today, and maybe I'll win next time. A very humble man. He was not freaking out about it. It happened, and he accepted it, and it's time for him to move on. And, Mike, it was a pretty incredible scene, quite frankly.
Yeah, you know, stunner in that, you know, it had to happen sooner or later. One would have thought, or, you know, maybe he could have retired that way, but everybody, and me included, not that I was looking past this fight for Overeem and Fedor, but in a way I was, and not that I was going to discount Werdum, I just didn't think that he would have enough for Fedor, but it just seemed to be, whether it was overconfidence, a lapse in judgment, whatever it was, that Fedor decided to stay there and get trapped. I mean, the armbar attempt was bad enough, and for him to stay in there and ended up getting wrapped up, it was just the way it was over so quickly. I mean, we've seen Fedor get rocked by Fujita and stay on his feet. We've seen him get rocked a little bit by other guys and be able to stay on his feet and fight back. We saw him get dumped on his head by Randleman. You know, it's whether you meant to do it or not, and I fall victim to this, you just kind of forget that Fedor was human. And for, you know, him to tap out so quickly last night and get tied up in the way that he did, it was a real, real shock, and it opens up some real, real questions for Strikeforce, because he's only signed to one other fight with them as far as the M1 deal. After the fight, you would have figured that there would have been some possible building up to, with Overeem being there, to the possibility of Overeem and Werdum, but Werdum said he would love to fight Fedor again. So you have a question over how it's going to work with who's going to fight Overeem and what more you can get out of Fedor if you're Strikeforce. I mean, there's probably no one happier right now than Dana White.
Yeah, on his Twitter last night, he just put a happy face. The rematch, I think, is the money fight. I don't think that's loss hurt Fedor. Well, I shouldn't say that. The loss hurt Fedor's management company's leverage. Fedor no longer being undefeated, the chances of them making a multi-million dollar deal with UFC now is very slim. Dana White saved himself a lot of money last night. I shouldn't say he saved himself. He found himself having saved a lot of money last night. Now, on the Strikeforce end, Fedor was extremely popular last night. Fedor is over in terms of Strikeforce fighters. Maybe not, obviously, to the level of a Gina Carano or their absolute top superstars, but he's
still a legend.
He's among them. He's among them that the people who are Strikeforce fans see as a genuine major league megastar. Now, the circumstances of his loss last night, I mean, we've seen this happen to everybody. I think most people, in seeing the way that this happened, realize that he made a dumb mistake early on. He got caught. It happens to everybody. There's a strong chance that in a rematch, he wouldn't go into the dude's guard, especially in the first minute of the fight when there's no sweat on either man, which was in many ways the most, I don't want to say the most foolish part, because just going into the guard haphazardly like he did was pretty foolish. But if this had happened in round two, for example, and both guys were drenched in sweat, then it's going to be a hell of a lot harder to tap a guy out in your guard than it is in the very first minute of the fight when you're both dry. And I think that the second time around, I think most people think that Fedor would either beat him or would have a very good chance of beating him. I think people see this for what it was. It's Dave noted on the show last night, it was very similar to the first Lesnar-Mir fight, where Lesnar went in there and he went all Donkey Kong on the guy and made a mistake. It happens. So this wasn't like a devastating victory where you look at it and when it's over, you're like, man, this guy should retire. He doesn't have it anymore. I mean, the first thing he did in the fight was knock the dude down. And had he not been as careless, he probably would have finished it rather quickly on the ground. So I think a rematch is money. I don't know how much money, but I think it's money, with the winner of that getting the Alistair Overeem winner. I don't think this is doom for Strikeforce or anything like that. I think that maybe in some ways it's a step back, but realistically, I think that Fedor versus Werdum 2 is a bigger fight than the first one, and I think that if Fedor wins that fight, then Fedor and Overeem is also big. So I think there are ways you can go with this to make it successful, and I don't see it as a complete disaster.
No, not at all. In fact, you could have gotten two pay-per-views out of this instead of just the one that everybody was thinking about of, okay, there's only one pay-per-view really fight that they have, unless Carano or somebody like that were to come back, and that's not going to happen. And it was Fedor and Overeem, and I think you could do a rematch and you could stack up an undercard. I don't know if you play the middleweight tournament into that, if Shields, which obviously Jake Shields is leaving, so they're going to end up doing that. And you try to have a women's match on there that is somehow more competitive. I think you can do that fight on pay-per-view, and regardless of the result, then you can have another heavyweight title fight on pay-per-view as well. And yeah, that's forgotten about in all this. I wonder if Werdum had already cleared out a spot for his very prestigious brand new Whamma belt that he has.
Actually, I don't know if he has the Whamma belt. I don't know if they even, I don't know what happened to that belt. The Whamma may be done.
You know, also, you know, not much money this cost Fedor in a lot of ways, too. But this week, leading up to this, the UFC, with their power and their influence, was able to put the kibosh on his seven-figure T-shirt deal from Tap Out as well. So Fedor's camp lost that money, too, this week.
It was a bad, bad day for Vadim and the crew. They looked so sad. Fedor,
somewhere Jerry Millen is crying.
Yeah, Fedor, well, I'm sure people were overjoyed at that. Fedor got beat, and then he just kind of sat there on his knees for a second, and he looked very sad to have failed. And then he got up and walked around the cage a little bit and such, and then it was finally time to interview him, and he stood there with his hands behind his back, looking exactly like he always does when he wins, and he did his little promo, and I think that he probably woke up this morning and went to bed last night really not all that concerned, quite frankly.
That's, yeah, you know, Verdum is, you know, his brother looks like that too, and Verdum is actually the only man now to be able to beat both of those men.
Yeah, Verdum was, I mean, they were the happiest people in the world, actually, before the fight even began. They were happy all week.
That was amazing, actually, to see him. And that was one of those things, too, when you see Fedor, you know, he never changes. He just seems like, you know, how much does he want to be there? Obviously, when he's in the ring, he's deadly. But to see a guy so loose leading up to such a big fight, I mean, Verdum obviously went in knowing he had nothing to lose, and he could not have been any looser.
Yeah, he had absolutely nothing to lose and everything to gain. And he capitalized on that. So, way to go, Fabricio Verdum. I don't think anyone's going to rank him the number one fighter in the world or anything like that, but he certainly moved up. And I guess, at least until this weekend, and we'll see what happens on Saturday, we'll talk about it in the next couple of segments, Brock Lesnar, I guess right now, would be ranked the number one heavyweight fighter in the world. So, we'll talk a little bit about rankings. I'm not a big fan of rankings. We'll talk a little bit when we get back for the break. We also have a lot of stuff to talk about. Strikeforce event, the retirement of Frank Shamrock. It was a great show on television, a really great show. Not show of the year or anything like that, but there were some very, very good fights. We'll talk about that. Plus, I want to open up the next segment with talk about the Cyborg Jan Finney fight, which, to me, one of the most appalling jobs of refereeing I've ever seen in my entire life. That's coming up here after the break. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Radio Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com, here for the next 2 hours talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, talking the Strikeforce show from the HP Pavilion last night, the first loss in 10 years of Fedor Emelianenko, and a fight. I just could not believe this fight, Mike. It was Mrs. Cyborg, the women's 145-pound champion, who has destroyed everybody they have put in her path, the newest foe, the 135-pound Jan Finney. Normally fights at 135. She bulked up for this particular battle. Overmatched. Everybody knew it going in. It looked to be a slaughter. It was, in fact, a slaughter. Mrs. Cyborg absolutely killed this poor girl and gave her such a tremendous beating. And the referee for the fight was Kim Winslow, who happened to also be a female. So we had three girls in the cage, and I don't know if Kim Winslow felt pressure that since she was a woman and these two fighters were women, that she had to let it go to maybe, I don't know, show the fans that she was as tough as a male ref. I don't know what the psychology was here in her brain, but she let this fight go on at least 5 minutes too long, in my opinion. I don't even know what to say, Mike.
And that's the thing. I mean, the Strikeforce last night, as far as the overall show, did a great job, you know, kind of watching the Miami and the Nashville, you know, what those shows were. They kind of got that taste out of their mouth, and it was a really good night. With the exception of that fight, the women's fight was, It's one thing, and I think there's a mental block anyway with a lot of guys of if a guy were to take that sort of punishment, it would be a little bit different in the fact that I think people look at it a little bit differently. With that said, the only time you let a guy take that kind of punishment, if it's somebody like a Don Fry or somebody like that who has got a history of, you know, Scott Smith even for that matter, if he was getting beaten up like that, because you know he's got the ability and he's shown the ability to take punishment and then come back with something. This girl had no, that wasn't even in her history anyway, so why let that continue on for as long as it did? It was brutal. It was brutal to see. Well, it would have been brutal for a dude, but it was even worse for a woman, and it's one of those things where it's like, if there's no one, if they can't get Cuffhill or whoever it's going to be, if they can't find an opponent for Cyborg, who probably walked in, she waited at 145. I don't know what she walked in at, but it was not 145. If they can't find an opponent for her, I'm sorry, she doesn't fight. Either that or you do what you did with Kung Lee during K1 pay-per-views and you have a fan show competition or something like that, because it's, you know, it's going to be tragic when something happens in MMA, but it's, you know, that girl could have been carried out on a stretcher. It would not have been a surprise if she got carried out on a stretcher. The way her face looked, the knee that she took, and the knee that she took in the second round when she slumped down should have stopped it there. I mean, there were multiple times when Cyborg looked, and I'm sorry to rant, but there were multiple times where Cyborg looked right at Kim Winslow, who has done a decent job with dudes. I mean, I never remember anything like this in a men's fight that she's refereed, including, I think she was on the WEC show last Sunday. She was definitely at the UFC show, one of the past ones. How, I have no idea why that was let to go on for that long, and shame on Finney's corner, and shame on the doctors too for not even suggesting that fight should have been stopped. She couldn't even get up between the first and second round. I mean, she was sitting there on her knees in the ring, and they were going to check on her like, this fight's over, she's not going to be able to make it back to her stool. Bad for everyone involved, with the exception, I mean, Finney did show guts and probably showed more guts than sense, but that kind of brutal beating, I'm sorry, just if they don't have an opponent for her that can be competitive, it's really not worth it.
I put all the heat on Kim Winslow, and I'll tell you why. This, to me, is like the MMA fighting version of your average Impact show, in that the guys on the show and the girls, all the wrestlers, they all work really hard. They all try really hard. I don't fault them that the show is stupid and doesn't make any sense. I question and I fault the people that write the show and put the show together. It's not Kim Winslow's fight that she wouldn't quit. You know what I mean? It's not her fault. That's just that she's a fighter. It's not
it's not her fault she didn't quit. That's fine. But, you know, the job of a referee and the corner, but especially the referee, is to protect the fighter from themselves.
Exactly.
There's nothing in her resume that would have let anyone believe that she could have come back with anything against Cyborg. It was ridiculous.
I agree 100%. I put no blame on the fighter. I put no blame on Cyborg, in fact, because Cyborg, I mean, the thing that I was so annoyed about was they let this fight go and go and go to the point where Cyborg appeared to be going at about 25% of capacity. She slowed down. She stood there over this woman. She kept looking at the ref like, do I have to kill this girl for you to stop this fight, or what do I have to do here? And Winslow just told him to fight. You've got to fight. And I could not even believe what I was seeing. And Jan Finney, you know, she wouldn't quit, that's true. But, you know, I not that this was going to lead to a death or anything like that, but I'm sure that there are people who have been killed throughout the history of the earth, and they fought till the very end. That's what people do when they're in danger. They keep fighting. I mean, it's just...
But, Brian, you know what it could lead to? And I know this is going to be kind of sounding overdramatic, but in a way, I mean, because we know how dangerous Santos is, it could have led to a broken face and then the end of her career.
Yeah.
So you look at it that way, too. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't going to lead to death, per se, but if it leads to the end of her career, is that any better?
It was like...
Arturo Gatti ended Joey Gamache's career by going in 20 pounds over. You know, he gained that in 24 hours and basically, you know, it rocked him so incredibly badly that his career was over afterwards. And that's, I'm just, and again, it is kind of dramatic to say that, but with, again, not being licensed in Melbourne and in New York and in Toronto, there still is needs to be a concern about these things and letting them go on too long when they're this Well, they're not even violent. It's so one-sided violent. This was, yeah, she channeled Yuji Shimada from Pride. You know, obviously the cut's not bleeding that bad, even though it's pouring all over the place. Fight. And that's what it was, and it was embarrassing.
Yeah, the arguments of, well, she was never out of it, and this and that. I mean, let's just think about that statement here for just a second. I realize that Cyborg is a monster, but she's, you know, a little over 145 pounds. And then you've got Jan Finney, who obviously has got a really hard head. I mean, you know, maybe Cyborg was not capable of actually knocking her unconscious. So are you telling me that we should allow Jan Finney to be hit in the head repeatedly for like 10 rounds just because she's never out of it? Of course not. This should have been stopped the moment Jan Finney had absolutely no hope, which was very early on in the first round when she was dropped and Cyborg went to work on her. And this fight was completely appalling to me, just appalling. And let me tell you, this had nothing to do with the fact that these were two women. I mean this in the nicest way possible, and I know I'm not the only one, but when most people see Mrs. Cyborg fighting, they're not thinking, hey, there's a woman in the cage. They're thinking, Jesus, look at this beast here in this cage. It's this Vanderlei Silva-like monster. And it was just a really, really good fighter against a fighter who was not in her league, and the really, really good fighter was killing this person. That was the disconcerting thing about this. It would have been the same with 245-pound guys. If Jose Aldo had been treating Uriah Faber like this, I'd have felt the exact same way. It just happened to be two girls in this appalling display.
Especially when one was nicknamed Cuddles.
Oh yeah, that was a rib. Cuddles.
Well, compared to Cyborg, I mean, she was kind of cuddly.
She's probably cuddling a neck brace and a halo right now.
She
hated this fight. Hated it!
Yeah, and for good reason. And that was the one. And again, Cyborg, just when you take out the brutal beating, as far as the whole card goes, how people get behind Cyborg, and in a lot of ways, she's more popular because she seems to be more approachable, I think, for fans than how Fedor seems. He just seems, you know, icy in a way. Even though people love him, I mean, I think not that they can relate to Cyborg, but they get into her fights more, and she's one of the biggest things they have, and obviously you need to feature her, but there's got to be something they can do to try to utilize her better, to try to get her other fights. You know what? I want to see her fight a man. I want to see her, you.
Me?
You should fight Cyborg.
If we had a grappling match, I would go in there, but no strikes. She'd eat me alive. Eat me alive. I will say.
And the show was good. And I mean, the fact that the reaction she got to, I mean, it did help the rest of the show. I mean, because the Frank Shamrock retirement was a fantastic thing. And the Smith Kung Lee fight was fun, too. But then again, I've always been pretty much an apologist for Kung Lee. But he really did look good last night.
I want to say quickly about her fighting men. I cannot remember what the circumstances were. But when she killed Gina Carano, I was at that show. And they had a press conference afterwards, and Gilbert Melendez had fought on the show. And somebody mentioned something about him fighting Cyborg. And, you know, it was obviously in a joking manner, but he kind of made it clear that that's a fight I probably wouldn't want to take. So it's she's, you know, she trains, obviously, with her husband, Mr. Cyborg. And, you know, in his last fight, he came in at 170, and realistically, when he came into the cage, she was probably heavier than he was. And I guess the word is that when those two train together, she out-trains him. I'm not saying that she would beat him in a fight, but as far as, like, you know, when they do all the drills and the sparring and the cardio and everything like that, she eats his lunch. And, she is a scary human being. We're going to talk about
the girl, like 5'9", too. So,
oh, yeah.
Jesus. Hey, Cyborg and Minoa, man. There you go.
We're going to talk about the final two fights on the show and the retirement of Frank Shamrock when we come back from the break. Then we'll delve into some pro wrestling. There's a lot of it to talk about, including the Fatal 4-Way pay-per-view. We'll get you up to date on that. Also, a lot of email questions flooding in. We'll get into those. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live every Sunday afternoon here on the Sports Byline Radio Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. And for the latest news and information on pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, always head to WrestlingObserver.com. Daily news updates, columns, and about a million radio shows covering every conceivable facet of half-naked men rolling around on the canvas in their underwear. $10.99 a month gets you not only the brand new newsletters that come out every week, but daily radio shows. In fact, we've got a full archive of shows dating back to 2005, thousands and thousands and thousands of hours of audio, both new and archived, available when you sign up. If you love this show and you only get to hear it once per week, consider signing up. If you've got a commute, if you head to the gym, if you do cardio, if you take walks, if you want more wrestling and MMA audio, WrestlingObserver.com is the place to go. You will never run out. We get emails, I swear to you, every week we get emails from people telling me, I can't keep up with all the audio. So believe me, sign up and you will not be disappointed if you love wrestling and mixed martial arts audio. Also head to WrestlingObserverShoots.com. Our newest DVD shipped on Friday. It is a look at the life and times of Abdullah the Butcher, a two-hour sit-down interview conducted by myself with Abdullah, including a bunch of bonus features, a tour of his Abdullah the Butcher House of Ribs and Chinese Food in Atlanta, Georgia. We've got exclusive matches. There's even an exclusive music CD. It's a two-DVD set and a CD as well, so three discs. It's available at WrestlingObserverShoots.com. We have two people lined up for future DVDs as well that we'll be announcing in the next couple of days. So we'll give you more information on that probably next week. But check it out, WrestlingObserver.com and WrestlingObserverShoots.com. And last night, Mike, the retirement of one of the legends of this sport, Frank Shamrock, is hanging it up.
Yeah, you know, boo to that. In that Shamrock's one of those guys, and I understand, I mean, by his own admission, he spends more time on the training table than he does in actual training. And, you know, at his age, and obviously, you know, even though he looked good against Kung Lee, the Nick Diaz fight was just a kind of a reminder that it was going to be over sooner rather than later. And I could still watch him, much like Jens Pulver, as long as he's not getting murdered out there. I hate to say it, I could still watch him fight anytime he wanted to, but he's one of the most valuable commodities they have behind the scenes. As far as his ability, I think, to talk to people and to be used in public relations situations and as an announcer, he is fantastic. He has good business sense, so he is going to be far more valuable for Strikeforce outside of the ring than he is in the ring, and he's done everything he could for that company and starting the shows off in San Jose and the fights against Diaz and against Kung Lee and you know, all the work he did in the UFC, too, the Ortiz feud that he had. And it's a great career. It's probably going to be one of those careers that, thank God for people like you and for Dave writing about it, because I think there's a lot of newer fans who came on early in the 2000s that aren't really going to ever, or in the mid-2000s, that aren't really going to be able to grasp how good Frank Shamrock was and how important he was because of the fact that he was in that dead area, and because of the fact that the UFC has gone out of their way, for whatever reason, to downplay his existence in all of MMA.
I've hung around a lot of pro wrestlers during my career and been to indie shows and met many of them. And you see a lot of older wrestlers that are really beaten up. And it's kind of funny that if you talk to people that have done both pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, they'll almost always tell you that pro wrestling is much harder on the body. In pro wrestling, I mean, you're willingly giving your body to people. They pick you up. They slam you. It's fake, but you take a real beating. And in mixed martial arts, I mean, you're doing a lot of grappling on the ground. I mean, I've never, in almost 5 years now, I've never suffered a single injury training jiu-jitsu several times per week. Whereas in pro wrestling, you know, it's a rare day where you do a match and you don't come out of it with something banged up. Now, with that said, I saw Frank Shamrock about a year ago, in fact, and we were going to someone's birthday party, in fact, and he was limping. He was moving very, very slowly. His knee was shot. His back was shot. He was just, you know, a real physical wreck. And this was a year ago. And keep in mind, he's fought since that time, which is, to me, inconceivable, having seen the condition he was in. And he was a guy that had never done pro wrestling, and he was 37 years old. And the difference was, Frank Shamrock started very, very young. He worked in Pancras at the age of 22 in Japan. And those guys, back at that time, before the changes in I guess the science behind fight training, I mean, you look at guys now like George St. Pierre and Rashad Evans, and you look at how these guys train, and it's very, very scientific. They're working hard to avoid overtraining, to avoid injuries, while at the same time reaching a peak that MMA fighters have never been able to achieve before. They've got these very specific training methods. Back in the days of Pancras and such, these guys would get in the ring and they would fight all the time. They went all out in training. They just beat the crap out of each other. And, you know, they got very, very good, and they got very, very tough. And in the late 90s, Frank Shamrock was, you know, perhaps pound for pound the best fighter in the world. And he was one of the best fighters of all time for his era. And unfortunately, that caught up to him with a vengeance. 37 years old and in just really bad physical shape. And it's too bad. He was a guy that, because of the falling out with UFC, he wasn't around in 2006, 2007, 2008 when they really hit it big. I mean, he would have been a megastar. He would have made millions and millions of dollars. And it's kind of sad the way it turned out, but I'm still very happy for him in the sense that, you know, he is a hometown hero. This is a horrible comparison, but Buddy Rose could always go around Oregon and eat for free in every restaurant he went into, and my guess would be that if Frank Shamrock really wanted to, he could probably do that. I mean, he is a legend in his hometown, and he's going to have a job in Strikeforce as long as there's a Strikeforce, so I'm very happy for him in that sense, but would have been nice if he would have had a career that would have allowed him to do some of this stuff in UFC.
My guess, it was most certainly Buddy Rose hit every single place he could up there for a free meal. But, yeah, at least he's going to have, Shamrock's going to have the job with Strikeforce, too. And a lot of guys can't say that who missed their time. At least he's going to have that. And at least history is going to, because, and that, you know, I should have mentioned the Pancras stuff, too. I mean, the fights against Boss Rudin and against Funaki and Minoru Suzuki and all the stuff that happened there, too. I mean, if it wasn't for, it's kind of funny, you know, if it wasn't for UWFI and Pancras, where exactly would we be right now? And where would we be right now without, you know, the Shamrock's adopted father who, you know, died earlier on this year, or it was late last year, and the effect that they had on that whole community, which ended up really spawning Strikeforce today?
The other two fights on the show very quickly, Josh Thompson beat Pat Healy in a very competitive fight. Thompson broke two ribs in the first round, which explains, for those of you wondering, why he completely ran out of gas in the second round. This is a guy that when he fought Gilbert Melendez, he was coming off an injury, and he had a very short window of time to train, and during that period, he couldn't even run. And he went in there with Gilbert Melendez, and they had a five-round cardio-filled war. And he ended up going into this fight healthy, but broke the ribs. And in round two, he just really didn't have a whole lot. And in round three, Pat Healy was totally blown up. And Thompson couldn't even take advantage of it until they finally ended up on the ground. And he ended up putting him in a body triangle and a rear naked choke for the submission. And he won the fight. I like Josh Thompson. I think he's a really exciting fighter, and I was very happy to see him gut through and get the victory here.
Yeah, and it's too bad Healy gassed out, and obviously he didn't know at all about the injury in the second round because he seemed to hold position on him, and I figure if he would have known that he would have been far more aggressive on Thompson, who, you know, Thompson made that round close for Healy, really pretty much controlling it the whole time. Thompson, at the end of it, ended up keeping it close, and the first round was actually very close as well, even though I had Thompson winning that, so a really good win for Josh Thompson, and it was a fun way to start the show.
And then Kung Lee and Scott Smith, rematch of the first fight where Kung Lee beat the crap out of Scott Smith for like three straight rounds, and then Scott Smith, with a desperation right hand, knocked him out. This was that same fight without the desperation knockout. Kung Lee went in there, not coming off a movie. He was healthy. He was in shape. He was a little tired, given that his wife gave birth on Monday after a 14-hour labor and a C-section when they discovered that the umbilical cord was wrapped around the baby's neck, which is never good times. But everything turned out all right. He went in there. He absolutely destroyed this guy, and Scott Smith didn't get his come-from-behind finish here. He just was beaten. So Kung Lee got his big win in his hometown. He's very, very happy to avenge his only loss. His only loss in MMA, San Chow, anything. And he was extremely happy about that, and it was a good time.
Yeah, it was going to be a test on how he came back at his age and after suffering that type of mental of having that first loss so late in your life. But came back with a vengeance, and Smith went after him, was very aggressive, but just couldn't hold up, and Lee was able to get some separation and hurt him with kicks. And a very impressive performance, although I'm not sure what was longer, the fight or the post-fight interview with Gus Johnson, who... Yeah, a little bit too much information there later on, but that interview went on for a little bit too long.
Let's do a couple of the emails before we head to the break. We only got a couple minutes here. This person wants to know, with Fedor now having a real loss on his record, has your top five pound-for-pound rankings changed? And if so, what are your new rankings? And what is your reaction to Bryan Danielson putting WWE PG over at last night's Chikara? I'm not a big proponent of ratings. I think that Fedor... Yeah, I was always kind of not a big fan of Fedor being in the top spot. I didn't really care all that much because ratings to me, it's not a fan. But, you know, given his level of competition of the last couple of years and that sort of thing, I thought it was kind of ridiculous to just assume that he was the automatic number one. But now I think it's pretty clear that he'd probably dropped to number two behind Lesnar. But I don't know about you,
yeah,
Mike.
Well, it's arguable. I mean, that's what a lot of people would point out. Dana White would point out, you know, the last time he had what one would call a high level fight, it was against Mirko, and that was in 2005. You know, so it's, you know, you go, how much credit do you give him? Obviously, you give him a lot of credit for the Nogueira victories and the Randleman victory and all of that stuff. But I mean, it's been a long time. Does he now pound for pound? No, he's not in that top five for me. As far as heavyweights go, there's a bigger question mark there. And, you know, again, I still, if Fedor goes, you know, obviously he got trapped last night, but he's still an incredibly, incredibly dangerous heavyweight.
The Bryan Danielson situation, I don't have time here to get into what I want to say about WWE PG. I'll say that in the second hour. I'm going to write that down here to make sure that we remembered. But I will say that as far as it's putting over the PG direction at last night's Chikara, Bryan Danielson is not going to go out there and bury WWE. I think he knows, I think everybody knows, that at some point soon, he's going to be rehired and brought back. He was the victim of, circumstances, is what happened. And I think he knows that. I think WWE knows that. I mean, obviously, I mean, if I were Bryan Danielson, the moment I heard Daniel Bryan chants on WWE TV, and they've been on TV for weeks now, and God knows they may even pick up steam. As soon as I heard those, I'd be making plans to go back because I think it's pretty much inevitable. But as far as WWE and the PG direction, I got a lot to say about that, and unfortunately we got two quick segments, so what we're going to do is we'll answer some more emails after the break. We'll go to the top of the hour break, answer some more emails when we come back, and then when we have our next long segment, I'm going to address this. So we'll be right back. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live on the Sports Byline Radio Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. Here for the next hour, talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. We got a short segment here, so let's get back into the mailbag questions. This person says, I found it interesting that Jim Ross has taken a smart Twitter outside look and perspective to WWE since his re-signing. Reading tweets on subjects like who will have their respective titles for a sure amount of time between Sheamus and Rey isn't something I think anyone is used to seeing from someone working for the company. Does he get free rein to write what he wants? It seems the rest of the crew have to kayfabe their tweets, but he says what he wants, when he wants. Well, he's kind of always done that in his blog. The wrestlers are more, they want them to tweet only about their storylines. I think with Jim Ross, since he's not on TV, since I think most of the people that probably follow Jim Ross, you know, this is not like John Cena. And actually, John Cena has, you know, he was outspoken about the Daniel Bryan firing. So, you know, guys are told to tweet about storylines and that sort of thing, but I mean, certain guys are you know, it's Jim Ross. They're not going to fire Jim Ross and let him go to TNA just because he did some tweets they didn't like. So I think it's just, you know, he knows who he is and what he can get away with. And I think he's probably not trying to, you know, he's not doing anything. He's not trying to get away with anything. It's just that's how Jim Ross is. He speaks his mind and he knows what to say without getting in too much trouble. And that's just how things go.
He is not Matt Hardy.
He is. Well, that's undoubtedly true.
Jim Ross is not Matt Hardy. Tweeting privileges, though, as the new anonymous GM.
Yeah. So it says, with the obvious lack of training of guys like Otunga and Cannon, how long till we see a very bad accident occur on national television? And how stupid and illogical is it of a worldwide company to take such a risk having these guys out wrestling with basic training? Seems such an accident does occur. What do you reckon will happen? Well, I mean, to be honest with you, I'm far more concerned about the girls. I mean, Kelly.
You. Women and neckbreakers.
Kelly and Rosa and girls like that. I mean, they're in far more danger than guys like David Otunga. So we could talk about that more after the break. But we actually have to head to a break. It's the top of the hour break, so we'll be back in about 7 minutes. But after that, we got another hour of pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Radio Network. How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on Wrestling Observer Live, here for the next hour, talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, joined, as always, by Mike Sempervivi of the Adam and Mike Big Audio Nightmare, available at WrestlingObserver.com. We got a short segment here, so we're going to jump right back into the mailbag, and then we'll get into some more talk about pro wrestling and MMA after the break, including my thoughts on WWE PG. Got a question about that earlier, and I want some time to get into that one. This person says, quick question about a Shamrock, though it's not Frank, but Ken, was he ever under consideration for a WWE title run? Actually, he was, but, well, things didn't happen. I think Bret Hart wanted to do a title program with Ken Shamrock, but then Montreal occurred. That was the end of Bret Hart, so obviously he wasn't around for that, and then I don't think there was ever thought of Shamrock winning it from Michaels, although they did have that feud, and they had the what the hell was that? It wasn't Beware of Dog. What's the name of that pay-per-view? And the Degeneration X pay-per-view, actually, I think, was headlined by Michaels versus Shamrock. So there was talk about it, but obviously it never came to pass. The person says, is Brian heard that he is featured in the Dixie Carter shoot interview, and she claims she has never heard of them? Does Brian believe this, and does he have any thoughts? I've heard that. I've heard the rumors. I will say that Dixie not knowing who I am or claiming to know who I am, even if she actually has no idea who I am, far less disconcerting than some of the things she said on that DVD about how, for example, she told the crew that if she heard one more Fire Russo chant, she was going to fire someone else. And, you know, she's a big proponent of Vince Russo, and that to me is...
Wait. That is very, very... For someone who's got no real knowledge of pro wrestling seemingly constantly, that seems like a very pro wrestling thing to do of, if I hear this about this guy, I'm going to fire someone else.
Yeah. How does that work? I don't know. It's... Yeah, she's still behind Vince Russo through thick and thin, and that to me is the most disturbing part about all of this. So I could care less whether she knows me or not. I just wish she would get a clue about her head writer. So this person here says, what about Lashley and Fedor? I know Lashley has a long way to go, but didn't he ask for better competition? Could this match work as a draw? Would it be too big a gamble for Strikeforce? I can't see how it could be worse than what just happened. Could it be? It's a possibility down the road. I would not write that off. I think it'd probably be a pretty fair drawing fight, but I do think that they need to do the rematch with Verdum first. I think that's one people want to see.
They tried to damn this at the opening of that show to hype up their heavyweight class, including Lashley, but you know what? Lashley's got to fight some guys first, and even if not, I mean, still, it's going to be nothing but a freak show matchup unless Lashley, you know, starts fighting some better competition here soon.
We'll be back in just a moment. Wrestling Observer Live, Sports Byline, Radio Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com, here for the next hour, talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts. As promised, I want to talk a little bit about the WWE PG direction. I've been hearing about this for a long time now. I get emails like every week. Always hearing about people that are very, very upset with the PG direction, and they think it sucks. They think it's maybe bad for business, whatever the case might be. These are my thoughts on this. I've thought about this for a while now. The WWE PG direction, in some ways, they go a little too far. I mean, a dude getting choked out with a tie, being fired, it's a little bit ridiculous. I mean, you can, you know, punch a guy in the face, you can hit a guy with a chair, you can do all this stuff, but you choke the guy with the tie, you gotta go. Some of this stuff I feel is going a little bit too far. I mean, you could still be PG and not do some of the over-the-top goofiness. Everyone should be happy that at least we don't have Hornswoggle in every segment on Raw. That's a positive that we don't have that. Now, the thing with PG is it's a new generation of people are coming up. I know that a lot of people that watch Raw to this day were people that were teenagers and young adults in the Attitude Era. And you remember all of the violence and the swearing and the handprints on the breasts and all the stuff that we saw during the boom period, and you yearn for that again. And that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. It was, you know, there was a lot of great stuff during the boom period. But you have to remember that for all the talk about creating new wrestling fans, the new wrestling fans that are being created nowadays are little kids. And granted, there were a lot more kids watching Raw during the boom period than there are today. But when you look at the demographics for Raw, when I was 19, 20, 21, 22 years old during the boom, I could look at the demos for Raw and they mirrored me. These people that were watching Raw during that period were right around the same age as I was. And as the end of the war came, and you've got 2001, 2002, 2003, I was in my late 20s, early 30s, looking at the demos. How about that? Late 20s, early 30s. Now, as it's 2008, 2009, 2010, I look at those demos, and 34, 35, 36, 37. The people watching Raw nowadays are the same people, largely. There are obviously some new people here and there, and some have given up. But a lot of the people that are watching Raw nowadays are the same people that were watching Raw during the boom period. So there are many of you that grew up watching all of this insanity, and you wish that there was more insanity today. However, there are a lot of people, and Mike is one of them, and my buddy Craig, and I have a lot of other friends that fall into this category where they're now 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37 years old, and they've got kids. And they've got kids that they would like to introduce to wrestling. And I'm sure that, Mike, while you are not a big fan of many of the aspects of this PG version of WWE, in some ways, it probably is nice to be able to watch Raw with your child, if that's what you do. And whether you do or not, there are many parents that would like to do this with their kids. And not have to worry about swearing and naked women and some of the insanity that we saw during the Monday Night Wars. To me, in 2010, based on the demos, you've got to have a project, a product that is closer to the PG that they are producing now than to what they were doing during the Monday Night Wars when we were all teens, early 20s, and just insane. It's a different time right now. It's a different audience. There are a lot of little kids growing up with their parents that their parents want to watch this show with their kids. And WWE is, what they're doing right now is really what they should be doing for this generation. Maybe they're going a little too far with it, but maybe they're not. I don't know. Business is doing just fine. It's not like PG has killed them. They're still grossing $500 million a year, and they're doing ridiculous numbers at house shows and in merchandise. Pay-per-view isn't great, but they're not going out of business anytime soon. And Mike, I don't know if you have anything more to add to that, but I firmly believe that some form of PG is the direction they should be going right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's what you said too, and I'll actually add another one to that. One, it's, yes, there's a lot of people that started watching, you know, wrestling for the first time when they were, you know, 11, 12, 13, 14, when the Monday Night Wars were going on. But as you said about the demographics, there were a lot of us that were turning 21, you know, between 18 and 25 in that span, that grew up as wrestling fans because when we were 6, 7, 8, 9, you know, that's when we became lifelong passionate wrestling fans. Back in 83, 84, 85, 86, 87, you know, up 89 for, you know, a lot of people, you know, watching WCW then and Flair Steamboat and all that stuff, they became lifelong fans then. So you have to try to hook, if you're WWE, you're trying to go back and hook those people from birth again so it becomes a regular thing. You know, obviously, it's, wrestling's not what it used to be, but, you know, they do have it more accepted and more, it's more of an everyday thing. It's what the UFC and what MMA wants. They just want to be every day, and they've done a successful job with that. But the thing is with the demographics, I mean, they have to go back and hook these people from a young age. That's why you're seeing the comic books again and some of the goofy wackiness you saw initially. They're going back to that. The other part of this is they've been very clear. You know, 7-Eleven and Mattel and Pepsi came on board as sponsors with them after the PG, you know, symbol went up in the corner of the screen. Part of this, it's like Daniel Bryan being the scapegoat. Part of this is purely 100% for public relations. And the more sponsors you bring in, whether anybody out there likes that or not, sponsorship, and we've seen this with Bryan and TV and all these other things, like with the guest hosts and USA wanting certain things, you have to acquiesce to them. So a lot of it is just a PR move, too, and that's something you can't get mad at if you're looking at it from WWE's point of view.
And if you want to make predictions here, I mean, among my friends in my age bracket and among people I know who are in the average demo for Raw nowadays, I mean, their kids are 3, 4, 5, 6 years old. They're right around that sort of age group there. And, you know, when those kids turn 13, 14, 15, 16... you know, that's the time where I think around, if wrestling is still around in some form in 2020 and 2025, somewhere in that span, then that's when I think that we're going to get something resembling the Attitude Era coming back, because you're going to have a bunch, all of these little kids right now that are growing up wrestling fans are suddenly going to become crazy teenagers, and they're going to want something more than Hornswoggle running around like an idiot on Raw. And I think WWE is probably going to recognize that at the time, and that's when we'll move away from PG and maybe more into a PG-13 style of wrestling. But for the time being, it's going to stay the way it is. And for those hoping that if Linda McMahon loses her Senate run, it's going to go back to R-rated WWE, think again. It has absolutely nothing to do with Linda running for Senate, and it's not going to change whether she wins or loses.
No, and you can say it in a tied-in way, yes, it does, a little bit. But you know what? It's just part of a greater thing that it happens to be there along with it, too. And you know, you bring up, like, kids, you know, things like Chikara, and even though they're goofy and very low rent, you know, some of the, you know, as far as how they look, with like the Showtime All-Star shows, in a way, it's good that those things are on if you do want to try to keep wrestling in your family. Because even now, I mean, my mother would hate, she hated wrestling. The only reason I was able to get away with wrestling is because my father was such a big fan growing up in New Jersey, so he passed that on to me. But she couldn't stand, you know, Jim Cornette in the Midnight Press hitting Baby Doll in the gut with a tennis racket, and now Baby Doll may never be able to have children again. And, you know, fireballs and things like that, that stuff's always going to be in wrestling. It's just to the level of it. And, you know, how much is too much? In the Attitude Era, it was too much. Yes, it was fun, but it was also an organic thing that came up from ECW and the changing of mentality and how we look at sports and our general attitude, too. Steve Austin was an accident. The Rock, in a lot of ways, how it turned out was an accident. These things come organically. You can't just go back and say we're going to have this time again, or they need to work to do that again. Sometimes it just needs to grow organically, and it's what they do with it when they have the chance.
We have to head to a break. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live on the Sports Byline Radio Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com, here for the next 2 hours talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, taking your emails and, yes, your phone calls, and we have a caller here on the line. You're on Wrestling Observer Live. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hey, what's going on, Brian? Hey, what's up, Mike? This is Alex Goff. I have a question about TNA. Nah, just kidding. This 170-pound tournament Strikeforce is putting on, do you think that a tournament format is the best way to crown the new champion, and then who do you see emerging out of it?
I'm fine with a tournament, and I actually like the idea of a tournament because it's something that UFC does not do. And obviously it's not going to be like a one-night tournament, but I know that the idea, I guess the general idea is they'll do a couple of matches or like the first round matches on one show. And I think they may do the semifinals and finals in one night, which is it's very different, obviously. UFC has done like the tournaments where, you know, two guys face off and two other guys face off on one show and then the winners face on a different show. But two fights in one night, it's kind of cool. But at the same time, you risk injuries and things throwing your tournament out of whack. But I do like them mixing things up. And I can't even make a prediction because we don't know who's going to be in the tournament or anything like that. But Mike, what are your thoughts on tournament style?
You know, I've always been, again, it's my age, too. I always love him in pro wrestling, and I like him in MMA a little bit, although from me, if I'm a promoter or if I'm the company, I would just do have four guys, have two matches on one show, because that way, if somebody gets hurt or something like that, you're still telling everybody, you know, these two men are still going to battle, you know, for this title when they're healthy enough. I mean, you can always have another guy go an interim if a guy's hurt too badly, but I just think there's too many variables that come up with having like an 8-man tournament or something like that. I mean, we saw just recently in the World Boxing Classic Super 6 they had with Jermaine Taylor having to retire during it. And I guess the one thing we do know about the Strikeforce tournament is that Nick Diaz will not be there, as he signed his consent order from Tennessee for being involved with the brawl that took place at the end of the Nashville show with Mayhem Miller and everybody involved in that. So he's going to be out for 90 days and fined $5,000, and he is definitely not going to be in that tournament if they're still scheduling it to start in Houston.
Let's head to the phones. You're on Observer Live. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hey, guys. It's Zombie.
Zombie.
Just a quick comment. I would like to know which officer approved of that Finney fight last night. And also, would it be possible to get Bill Douglas on Figure Four Daily to discuss what the commission's view would have been of booking that fight? I mean, it's just not fair. I'm sorry. It just wasn't fair, and it was a slaughter. But it was a good show, and Fedor, you know, what can you say? Redoom shocked the world, but it was cool. It was definitely cool being there.
Yeah, but, I'm not sure who approved that fight. I know that Bill Douglas is no longer with the commission, but I do hear from him here and there, so we can try and get him on the show to talk about that. It actually would be interesting. I would bet that if Bill Douglas were still with the CSAC, we would not have seen that fight. But he's not, so we saw it. And
you know, the other thing with Verdum, too, that comes out of this, I mean, he was kind of jettisoned away from UFC, kind of booted in the ass out the door, you know, when it looked like Krokop was leaving and everything else when he lost to Dos Santos. Now, the one that Junior Dos Santos has been on, that last loss that he has doesn't look so bad anymore.
That's true, yeah. He redeemed himself in many ways last night, and they didn't show enough of the post-fight stuff, but apparently the press conference, I mean, he came off as a complete superstar, so hopefully
yeah,
they can...
Yeah, and that's where I'm kicking myself in the ass a little bit, and I'm sure a lot of other people are, too, the ones who aren't being... And this is another thing, too. It's amazing how much MMA guys don't want to be linked in with pro wrestling. They'll be the ones to bitch that Brock wasn't fired up enough trying to sell the fight last week, and they love people like Frank Shamrock and stuff like that. I mean... Verdum, you know, went to a unanimous decision with Nogueira in Pride. I mean, it's not, you know, we completely look past him, and that's shame on me for doing that, too. Because, you know, in hindsight now, it's just in hindsight, it's not that big of a shock. And it's going to be interesting, too. I mean, Dave interviewed Fedor this week, I believe, for Yahoo, and talked about how calm he was and everything else. And it's questionable. You know, there may be a question, and it may not be a big one, but I think there is going to be a question that gets floated out here, too, of how much does Fedor really want to do this?
I guess
that's going to be, you know, very blatant in his next fight of how much longer he has left and what his interest level is.
Let's go to the phones. You're on Observer Live. Who is this and where are you calling from? You are on the air. Going once. Going twice. He failed. I think Fedor really likes to fight. I think he enjoys it.
But would he be happy just doing it in sambo tournaments in Russia with nobody there? He probably would. I just wonder, as far as all the BS that goes with it, and being basically a machine for these other men to make money, as his brother has called him out to be, as far as the people that are around him, I mean, I wonder how much that weighs on him.
Well, sure.
It was almost comedic, you know, with the head in the hands way that they were selling that loss.
Well, yeah, but I mean, he's making a lot of money to do this. So, you know, if he loves doing sambo, I mean, I'm sure he loves doing MMA, and sambo tournaments aren't making him the kind of money that MMA is. So I think he enjoys it. I mean, listen, to me, you cannot be as good as Fedor Emelianenko is if you don't really, really love it. I mean, he may not show it, but, you know, say what you will about level of competition, everything like that, but to go undefeated for 10 years in your sport, you gotta love it. You just have to. At least that's my opinion. Let's go back to the phones here. You're on Observer Live. Who is this, and where are you calling from? Why do people call and then not say anything? Got this email question here. Is there any chance that Drew McIntyre will be the Raw GM? No, they've been burying him match-wise, but they've also been giving him a lot of TV time, and going straight from that to deported seems like a pretty sudden change. I don't think he's going to be Raw GM. I would not be surprised if he went from deported to world champion using the Money in the Bank briefcase. I would be stunned if he did not win at Money in the Bank, especially if they end up doing two of them. You know, I would be very, very shocked. I think that that's the direction they're going. Deported is goofy, but they've been doing a lot of goofy stuff here, and it's almost becoming too much of a cartoon. But I would say deported right to sent back for the ladder match.
I hope it's Tiffany.
Tiffany?
She kept Law and Order on ECW. She can come back and do it again on Raw.
I see. And he also, this person says, do you think there's anything of the fact that Sheamus and the NXT guys have never attacked each other on camera? They've chased Sheamus off several times. Sheamus scared them off with a pipe. There's never been physical contact. Could the writers be intending to put them together and actually planning ahead? Well, actually, I can tell you they're not planning ahead, but
yeah,
that might have been an idea, and they could go that direction, and they may not go that direction. They're literally writing everything week to week, which is why a lot of this stuff, including the angle this past Monday night where they all attacked and beat up Vince McMahon, I mean, there's a reason a lot of this stuff makes absolutely no sense, because they're going week to week. So.
Oh, yeah, and you know, and that's going to be, as it goes on, it's going to be even more convoluted. One would have to figure with how they've been in trying to do storylines like this, it should go long term, that things are going to get out of order. But in a way, I'm not willing to give up on it yet, because they have left, whether they've meant to or not, they have left enough holes in with a lot of things with Jericho, Sheamus, Michael Cole, who's the GM, all that stuff. They've left a lot of it open where there's a lot of things you could do. It's just having faith in them to go ahead and do it, and to hear that they're basically booking on the fly week to week is kind of tough, especially because it's pretty much a contained angle on Raw. You don't see these guys on SmackDown. You're not seeing them on NXT. It's 100% contained to Raw and then the possible weekly run-in during a house show.
You're on Wrestling Observer Live. Who is this, and where are you calling from?
Hi, Brian. This is Mike Martin from Monticello, New York. Can you hear me?
Yep. What's going on?
Hey, man. First, I want to thank you and Dave for I've had some of my stuff published on the Wrestling Observer website, and it's really been an honor every time I get something that's able to be on the front page. I want to talk a little bit about Strikeforce last night, especially the Cyborg fight. You know, I thought that was an absolute atrocity the way that fight kept going on. And I what was up with that ref last night?
Yeah, we talked about this in the first hour. I mean, I feel the exact same way. I can't read her mind. You know, when I watched it, I just kind of had this feeling that she had... I don't want to say she had pressure on her. I feel that she might have put pressure on herself being a female ref in there refereeing a fight between two women, and maybe feeling that if I call this too early, there's going to be a lot of heat on me, because I'm a girl and they're girls, and so I'm going to let it go on a little bit longer. I don't know what she was thinking, but that was my initial thought, because, you know, this fight should have been called, you know, in the first round, and to go as long as it did in the second was appalling.
Absolutely. And you know, I saw the, I enjoyed the show overall. It was a pretty good show, and I was completely shocked at how quick Fedor lost to Werdum last night. It was really, you know, it goes to show you the difference between MMA and pro wrestling is that, you know, anything can happen at any time in MMA, whereas you can keep your stars, once you create them, if they're popular in pro wrestling, you can keep them on the top based on how you book. In MMA, you can't do that. And, you know, it really makes it's interesting, and I love it. I mean, I love the upset last night, but at the same time, sometimes it's hard to keep your stars at that top level. What do you think about Fedor going forward? Do you think this is just a one-time fluke thing that he got caught off guard, or do you think this is really going to have any long-term effects on his career?
I would not call it a fluke because it was a great submission, and he was in position to be armbarred, and he got out of it, and then he stayed in the same position and got himself triangled. So he screwed up. I mean, this was Fedor's fault. I can't call this a fluke or anything like that. I don't see this affecting his career too much going forward in the sense that, you know, I think he's still going to be very popular with fans. I think he's still going to be a draw. I mean, it's affected his management company, obviously, as we talked about earlier. They're not going to get the money that they wanted to get when they first turned down a bunch of UFC offers. But, yeah, it's I'm going to talk about this a little bit more when we come back from the break. We're up against the clock right here. But, yeah, I and Werdum, I want to talk about this a little bit as well when we come back. I mean, I'm not saying it's a fluke, but Werdum made it very clear during the post-fight press conference that he had to end the fight early, and he did. So we'll talk about that when we get back. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live on the Sports Byline Radio Network. We are back here on Wrestling Observer Live. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com. Here for the next 20 minutes, talking pro wrestling and mixed martial arts, taking your emails and phone calls. And we got a caller here on the line. You're on Observer Live. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Yeah, this is Tim from Richmond, Virginia.
Tim, what's up?
Hey, y'all have been talking about this the entire time, but I was calling because I've been reading different things about the Fedor and Werdum loss last night, and I was I read that there are rumors that Fedor was through the fight because he was being considered as like a god or an idol, and his religion or his background kind of made that a definite no-no.
I have not heard that. I have been on enough message boards to fully believe you that rumor has spread, because it's not true. He got caught in an armbar. You know, it's actually funny that I don't know. It's like he did say that people have you know, they look at me as an idol, and they shouldn't. I'm just a human being. And that rumor right there is proof of what he was saying. There are people that, for whatever reason, cannot wrap their heads around the fact that Fedor got submitted in a minute. And so they come up with various ideas about, well, he must have thrown the fight, you know, and this would be why, based on what he said. The reality is, he got caught in an armbar triangle and he couldn't get out of it. It happens to everybody, and it just happened to him this particular night, and that's just the reality of fighting.
And I got one more little thing. I also had a friend there that kind of saw something going on, but that Gilbert Melendez and Jake Shield got into an altercation near Fist Fight last night at the show. Have y'all heard anything about that?
I have not heard that, and in fact, I had a couple of friends that went to the show, and nobody mentioned it to me. I can check on that. But Mike, did you hear anything about that?
No, I didn't at all.
Yeah. The Fedor thing, I want to talk about this again very quickly, and I'm not surprised that rumors like that have spread, because that's just how people are that you know, they...
Is that
a
rumor, or is that just like, I mean, again, talk about MMA fans using wrestling fantasy booking. I mean, why don't they just go ahead and say that Werdum threw his fight in UFC, and then, you know, he was sent by Dana the same way that Vince sent Bret Hart to go ruin WCW? Or, you know, he sent the NWO to go ruin WCW. I mean, that is one of the more ridiculous things I think I've ever heard, just because the man has already lost. I mean, say what it was about the cut loss to TK, but he's already lost.
Yeah. The Verdum actually said this during the press conference when they asked about his strategy. I mean, he said, you know, I have to finish this fight early because if it goes any length of time, we're both going to be sweaty and it's going to be really hard to get him in a submission. And, you know, the fact that this went 109, I mean, to me, that doesn't surprise me because the fight, if he was going to submit Fedor, it was going to happen within like a minute nine or a minute four or a minute three or whatever it was. I mean, him submitting Fedor in round two would have been extremely difficult. And, you know, people look at the 109 and they're like, oh my God, this, you know, Fedor, he slipped this and that. No, he just got caught very early on before he got sweaty, and that made it tough for him to get out. If it had been 109 of round two, then he probably would have gotten out of these things. So,
yes, when upsets happen.
Yeah. I mean, it's you know, if you've trained jiu-jitsu or anything like that, I mean, everybody who's trained for any length of time has seen an instructor that is at a much higher level than a student, and they're rolling around, and the student just happens to catch him. It may happen once every year, but every now and then it just happens for whatever reason. Maybe the instructor laughed. Maybe he had a lasp. Maybe he decided, oh, I'm gonna see if I can get out of this move, and oh, I can't get out of it. These things just happen. And it happened last night, and God knows, maybe Fedor's going to go 10 more years before it happens again. But these things happen, and that was an example of it. So there you go. The Martha Hart lawsuit, Mike, she's filed suit against WWE. She's very unhappy that they're still using Owen Hart in videos and DVDs. And this is the most astounding part, she claims that in the 37 or so DVDs that Owen Hart has been featured in since he passed away, she has not gotten any royalty money.
If there's a way for, I mean, look, I would assume on the surface from what I know and from what I read, I think both parties are right. I don't think that no matter what the booking agreement says, there was no way WWE or WWF or E at the time, they're never going to give up rights and never use Owen Hart again. I cannot believe that there would be anything as good as they are with small print and the whole nine yards. That's impossible. That is just impossible to me. With that said, their arrogance gets me sometimes in things that seem to be, if you're going to put it at the most mildest, that it was overlooked. But, you know, at worst, like when it came to, you know, the whole World Wildlife Fund thing where they just said, ah, sure, we're going to do it anyway. If that was even remotely the mentality that they had with this, I'm really shocked. Because if you were to get called out for this the same way Jesse Ventura did to them and said, I'm owed those royalties, I mean, they've already been through this. I mean, they have contracts set up and they're very tight in how they own names and how they're going to pay royalties and all that other stuff. I'm really surprised that they didn't even put, and I don't mean to sound conspiratorial here, but they put money in escrow just in case she were to find out that these DVDs were coming out. I mean, she doesn't pay attention to the wrestling business. I'm sure they knew that, but they had to have figured when they were planning on bringing Bret Hart back and WrestleMania and doing the Hart Dynasty DVD that this might possibly become an issue. Maybe they were so arrogant or just completely overlooked it, but I can't see how she's not owed any money whatsoever. With that said, I can't see how she's going to prevent them from ever using anything that had Owen in it at all from WCW, from when they buy stuff from New Japan or stuff that they already have in their own library.
It is the one thing that's kind of, well, I mean, obviously the most astounding thing about it is they have not been paying her royalties, but what was interesting to me is it would seem to me that if I were Martha Hart, I would file suit asking for royalties. The idea of filing suit asking for royalties and also asking for them to never use Owen Hart footage again is weird to me in the sense that I have talked to people that have gotten royalty money off DVDs, and it is a good sum of money. I mean, some of these guys are making a lot of money off of these DVD appearances. And if she's owed money for 37 DVDs, she's got a windfall coming. And that windfall can all be put towards the Owen Hart Foundation. And to me, I'm not Martha Hart. I probably shouldn't even talk, but I realize that what happened was a tragedy. I realize that she really hates the wrestling business. But in a sense, it's almost like it should be fine. But if I were Martha, I would be okay with them creating DVDs that featured my husband and getting the royalties and taking all of that money and putting it into the Owen Hart Foundation. Because that's the idea behind the foundation, is you're using this money to help other people. And for me, I mean, it's like, yeah, I mean, the whole thing sucks, but if I can get some money to give to these people through my foundation based on appearances of Owen in DVDs, then I would be okay with that. And it's kind of weird to me, I guess, that she doesn't want him featured on any of these DVDs, yet at the same time she wants the royalty money.
But Brian, I mean, from her point of view, though, going back to the foundation is set up, the settlement money that went to it, she wants nothing to do with it. If they're being successful in selling DVDs using the likeness of your husband, who you said didn't really like the wrestling business, although people dispute that, and that you hated, and that you think killed your husband, and they took him away from you, then you're rooting for the success of WWE, not rooting, but you have to hope for the success of WWE for them to put money in those sales, and she doesn't want that, and I can understand that.
Well, you don't have to hope for the success.
No,
but
you're not hoping, but at the same time, if there's going to be any money that comes in off those DVDs and off those royalties, it means because they sold them, and it's still a business that she's looking at killed her husband.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know. I just figure that, you know, if the DVDs are going to be sold, you may as well use the money for a good cause. You know what I mean? That's the way,
yeah,
I'm looking at this. I mean, to me, the options are either no money comes in because you're not allowing any Owen Hart footage to be used, which A, is going to be a tough legal battle anyway, or B, just take all that money and put it towards a good cause.
Well, that's when it ricochets back, though, too. And that's why I can't blame her for any of this, because, I mean, people brought this up about the, about the Connecticut campaign. No, look, she put that injunction in when she found out it was going to be released in Canada. And there's a very legitimate possibility that she had no clue that, like, on the best of, you know, a Cruiserweight DVD or something like that, that they were using footage of him. You know, I can see how she actually didn't know that. But with that being said, it reverts back to blame on WWE in that, even if you remotely thought that there was a possibility, why did you not stick money away, or why did you not try to contact her or contact her through other family members or anything to say, we're doing this, you're going to get money out of the deal? That's where, from a business and a public relations, again, they're so careful about so much when it comes to public relations sometimes, that I just figured I was giving them too much credit that they would be kid gloves with the Owen Hart, Martha Hart situation.
I would just have paid the royalties.
that's true, but it's amazing. It's kind of an amazing, weird, sad thing still.
I mean, it's just like, I know they still pay royalties to Ken Kennedy, you know what I mean? Who they fired and is on the don't call list. I mean, this is like, he's still getting his royalty money. I mean, they're still paying royalty money to everyone, yet not Martha Hart?
No, I'm sure they're doing it to Bruno. They ripped Bruno to shreds, or not really ripped him to shreds, but made him look so poor during the WWE 24/7 roundtable on the 70s they were doing, and I'm assuming they're paying money to him, too. So, yeah, why they just wouldn't do it, or at least, at the very least, set it up so it was going somewhere else just in case this were to happen and she were to find out that they knowingly did this is beyond me.
What are your predictions for Lesnar-Carwin this weekend?
Lots and lots of buys, much like Rashad, and because obviously this card is kind of, I don't want to say it's fallen apart in a lot of ways, but, you know, it has. Volkman was supposed to fight. I'm not sure if he's still on there or not, but I thought his fight was scratched. Chuck Congo and Roy Nelson were supposed to fight. Now that's been scratched. Wanderlei Silva off the card. Chris Leben on 2 weeks' notice goes in against Yoshihiro Akiyama, who I know a lot of people kind of ripped him a little bit for questioning going into that fight, but to be honest, from his point of view, if I'm his camp, I'd be a little worried too. But it doesn't really matter. Brock Lesnar's on top of it. It may not do more buys than UFC 100, and I don't think it will, but it's going to be, you know, Rampage Rashad territory of high nines, around a million buys just because of Brock Lesnar, and should be huge success for them, I would assume, and hopefully Kurt Pellegrino gets some nice camera time. I think he's fighting on one of the preliminaries because you can't go wrong with that, man.
Yeah, the show this weekend coming up from Vegas. I'll be down there covering the event, so probably not a new show next week. But we'll talk a little bit more about that after the break and get into some final notes as well. You're listening to Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Radio Network. We are back here for the final segment on the show. Brian Alvarez here from WrestlingObserver.com, joined by Mike Sempervivi, also of WrestlingObserver.com, here on Sports Byline USA. Every Sunday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern. And Mike, you had a chance this week to check out the Ricky Steamboat DVD.
Yeah, did a great job with it. WWE, obviously, they took some WWE liberties with it, but it was nice that they didn't just focus on the Flair Steamboat feud that they had in WCW when Steamboat first broke in. They go into a lot of his work with Youngblood against Slaughter and Canoodle and the Briscoes, which is when I started becoming a fan of him, and they concentrate on that, and they did a pretty darn good job throughout the whole thing. Obviously, there's been some missteps here and there, but they did a nice job, especially leading into what he did at WrestleMania and the fact that his son, Ricky Steamboat Jr., is wrestling right now, too. They did a nice little feature on him at the end. So, all in all, not a bad DVD as far as the documentary goes, and the matches right then and there, that makes it worth whatever money it costs.
And Ricky Steamboat theoretically could be in, yes, Season 3 of NXT. It's in the works, everybody. So for those of you loving Percy Watson and the wacky crew, there's an even wackier crew perhaps on the way as well coming up for Season 3 prior to them getting canceled from the Sci-Fi Network. We are out of time for today, but don't forget next Saturday is Lesnar versus Carwin. I'll be there live in Las Vegas, so probably not a new show next week, but we'll be live the week after. You can always check out the archives at Sports Byline USA, and always sign up at WrestlingObserver.com for more radio. We do a new show every single day, pretty much, covering everything under the sun, pro wrestling, and mixed martial arts. Don't forget Raw tomorrow. Rob Zombie is the guest host. For those of you unaware of that, yes, it has been a very deeply kept secret, apparently, that Rob Zombie is going to be on the show. One of the final guest hosts, perhaps, as they appear to be losing interest in that that deal there. It was supposed to go through WrestleMania, but now it looks like they may be winding down. So check out Raw tomorrow night. Check out WrestlingObserver.com. Thanks, as always, Mike and everybody for listening to Wrestling Observer Live here on the Sports Byline Radio Network.